We're announcing the Department of Environmental Conservation's revised recommendations for mitigating the environmental impacts of high-volume hydraulic fracturing. I will probably stumble on those times, but every time I'm referring to high-volume hydraulic fracturing or fracturing, that's what I'm talking about, those four words. Since Governor Cuomo extended the executive order to issue a revised SGEIS, which is the Supplemental Generic Environmental Impact Statement, our staff at DEC has been working very hard to take another look at high-volume fracturing to make sure we get it right. The goal of the process all along has been to identify the risks associated with high-volume fracturing to see if they can be mitigated in a way that protects the environment and allows this activity and the economic and energy benefits associated with it to move forward in New York. I think we've done that. We know there was inadequacies in the 2009 SGEIS. The 2011 document addresses these adequacies through more vigorous mitigation measures. In preparing the revised document, we've engaged independent consultants to perform additional research regarding various socioeconomic impacts. That is going to be plugged into this document later this summer. We've requested and received more information from the drilling industry. We've carefully considered 13,000 public comments from all stakeholders, individuals, organized environmental groups, industry experts, and municipal officials. Let's grab some water. And obviously, we studied the regulations and experiences of other states where drilling has taken place so that we can learn from them. The 2011 document contains approximately 150 more pages of data and analysis than the 2009 version. And based on this new and additional knowledge, we've developed a whole series of recommendations that go far beyond what was proposed in 2009. Under our proposal, high-volume drilling would be prohibited within the New York City and Syracuse watersheds and within 4,000 feet of that boundary. It'd be prohibited in all primary aquifers and on state-owned lands, including state parks, wildlife management areas, and reforestation areas. High-volume drilling would be permitted on private lands, but only under new, rigorous, and effective measures that mitigate the environmental impacts. We are going to do this safely. And once the final document is released, DEC will issue regulations to codify the recommendations we make in the SGEIS. So let's just go over the significant changes from version to version. The new version would protect the state's environmentally sensitive areas while also realizing economic development and energy benefits, as I mentioned before. With the changes to ensure strict mitigation and monitoring measures, we believe high-volume fracturing can be done safely in New York. More than 80% of the deep Marcellus shale areas where drilling can practically be done will still be accessible for gas, for accessing gas resources. Now, that's important because we have a whole new series of setbacks from sensitive environmental areas, water supplies, steep slopes, you name it. We have setbacks from all the sensitive areas. But even after all of that, we believe you can get to 80% or more of the resource. So I'm just going to discuss a few of the changes in more detail. There's currently 8 states with high-volume fracking underway. And in effect, New York is really the only remaining state that has the potential for high-volume fracking. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, shale gas production comprised 16% of total U.S. production. By 2035, the EIA estimates that shale gas production will grow to 47% of total U.S. production. In the Marcellus Shale, well sites have been developed extensively in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio. Those dots represent well pads, in effect, and you can see, obviously, high clusters of them across Pennsylvania. You even see some in New York, but those are not high-volume hydraulically fractured sites. Those are vertical wells, which have been happening in New York for years. Last month, DEC staff and I visited Leroy Township in Bradford County, as I was directed to do so by the governor. We learned what went wrong there with when fracturing fluid released and escaped to a nearby waterway. We didn't just stop and look at that one site. We looked at all of the incidences that have happened in Pennsylvania and elsewhere to to make sure we knew as best we could what happened, what the problems were, and how to correct them in New York so they wouldn't happen here. We incorporated specific controls into the revised document to address all those errors that we found in other places. These include better stormwater controls, more rigorous equipment testing before it's used in the drilling process, and increased monitoring by DEC staff. So what are the specific controls and measures that we're recommending to safeguard the environment? Our top priority, obviously, is drinking water. As I said, surface drilling will be prohibited in New York City, in the New York City and Syracuse watersheds. It'll also be prohibited 4,000 feet around those watersheds. This is obviously a significant departure from the 2009 draft. These water systems, the Syracuse and New York, are the only unfiltered water systems in New York State. They are two of a few around the nation. They are unique, they are precious, and they are unfiltered. So we concluded that it was just inappropriate to drill in those watersheds. Surface drilling will also be prohibited in the state's primary aquifers and within 500 feet of their boundaries. Now, primary aquifers presently serve municipalities. They are a main source of drinking water, as opposed to principal aquifers, which we've also have strict new regulations on. Principal aquifers are basically backup aquifers. They are not used at present, but obviously represent a future potential. As I've stated also, high-volume fracturing wells will not be sited on state-owned land, such as state parks, forests, and wildlife management areas. This industrial activity is simply inconsistent with the purposes for which these areas were acquired and the public's use of them. Remember, though, that even with these restrictions, 80% or more of the deep Marcellus shale is still accessible. And it'll be allowed on that private land with very rigorous and effective controls, which we think are state-of-the-art in the country. Permits won't be issued for sites within 500 feet of private water wells or domestic use springs. Another new measure we've added to protect drinking water is additional intermediate well casing that will be included to prevent gas migration. This intermediate well, or intermediate casing rather, is just yet another layer of protection between water supplies and gas that's underground. It hasn't necessarily been used in all cases in the past, and a lot of the incidents where there was well migration, or gas migration rather, in places like Pennsylvania were because of either intermediate casing wasn't used or there was things like improper cementing, all of which we address in the SGIS. Let's see. So this means, by the way, when intermediate casing is included, there'll be three layers of casing used in a well: surface casing, intermediate casing, and the production casing. Each one of those casing layers, it's literally a pipe that goes down into the well, is then cemented to prevent any migration in or out of that pipe. Rigorous containment measures will be required for all fracturing additive containers, staging areas, flowback storage tanks to ensure that any spills of wastewaters or chemicals at the well pad do not migrate into water supplies. This is what a typical well pad looks like. You can see the berm around that pad. In the case of Leroy, Pennsylvania, at the Chesapeake site, it was that containment area that actually sloughed with all of the advent of spring rains and spring thaw. The berm area actually settled in the corner of the containment area, and when they were overwhelmed with stormwater and the fluids leaking out on site, it actually breached that berm and flowed down the hill and into an unnamed tributary of the Towanda Creek. And the problem in that case was defective equipment. There was a flange on the pipes at the top of the apparatus above the well that actually breached and leaked, and the leak took about 12 hours to contain. We're also proposing a new set of strong stormwater controls and increased regulation of water withdrawals. Following the governor's signing of DEC's water withdrawal legislation, which the state legislature recently approved unanimously, a special permit will be required to withdraw large volumes of water for industrial and commercial purposes to ensure that there aren't any adverse impacts. All withdrawals from surface water bodies will be subject to strict limits to ensure that natural flows are maintained so that fish and other aquatic resources can be protected. Excuse me. Since the 2009 SGIS, many drilling companies have started to recycle much of the flowback water, greatly reducing the need for its disposal. However, we do have new proposals on how to handle any flowback waste that is not recycled. First, applicants must have a DEC-approved plan for disposing of flowback water and production brine. DEC would institute a process to monitor disposal of flowback water, production brine, drill cuttings, and other drilling wastes. This process would be similar to how medical waste is now handled. It would have to be manifested. They would have to have a plan for where it's going to go and demonstrate that the receiving entity has the proper permits and the capacity to treat those wastes. Finally, we will continue to require that any and all waste proposed to be disposed of at a wastewater treatment plant are fully assessed and that effective treatment systems are in place and permitted before drilling wastes are accepted. All drilling waste applicants would be required to submit a plan, as I just said. This would include an extensive review at the treatment facility itself, known as a headworks analysis, to make sure that the treatment plant can treat the type of waste that are coming into it. And they'll be tested before they come so that they'll know what the constituents are. There's also new protections for air. The new recommendations in our SGEIS will require enhanced air pollution controls on all engines used at the well pads, and DEC will monitor local and regional air quality at the well pads and surrounding areas. In addition, we will require the use of existing pipelines when available rather than flaring gas to reduce emissions. And finally, applicants will be required to submit emission impact mitigation plans that include best management practice for greenhouse gas sources, a leak detection system, and the use of reduced emission completions. Another important area to consider when looking at drilling is the impacts to local governments, of course. And we saw many of those impacts when we were in Pennsylvania. The 2009 SGEIS just did not adequately address these issues. And we've hired a consultant, which is going to report back to us about July 31st on both the socioeconomic impacts, economic impacts, transportation, visual impacts, all the important impacts locally that we felt were just not adequately addressed the first time around. So that is a piece that will be added to the SGEIS about the end of July. We also have a provision in the SGEIS for local government notification. Whenever DEC receives an application, the local government will be notified, and the applicant has to certify that their plans are consistent with local zoning ordinances. If they aren't, and they can't make that certification, or the local government disagrees with them, DEC will review whether or not they think they comply, and they will include a permit condition that specifies that they have to comply with local zoning. If they don't, those situations could very well end up in court, but DEC will make its best effort to make sure that those applicants comply with local zoning regulations. I've said repeatedly since my confirmation hearings on that DEC's oversight and enforcement of high-volume fracturing will be rigorous and effective. Permits will only be issued consistent with DEC's ability to oversee and ensure compliance. To help guide the agency with the implementation of the measures detailed in the SGEIS, I have established a high-volume hydraulic fracturing advisory panel. Very clever name. The panel will be charged with developing recommendations to ensure DEC and other agencies like DOH and the Public Service Commission have the proper capacity to oversee, monitor, and enforce high-volume hydraulic fracturing activities. The panel will also develop recommendations to avoid and mitigate impacts to local governments and communities, and it will evaluate the current fee structure and other revenue streams to fund government oversight and infrastructure related to high-volume hydraulic fracturing. The panel members, which were intended to represent a wide variety of interest, industry, environmental groups, and government. Stan Lundeen, the former New York State Lieutenant Governor, Kathleen McGinty, former chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality under President Clinton, Eric Goldstein and Kate Sinding from NRDC, Robert Hallman, who is the board chair of the New York League of Conservation Voters, Robert F. Kennedy, representing the Waterkeeper Alliance, Robert Moore, the executive director of Environmental Advocates, Mark Brownstein, the chief counsel of the Energy Program of the Environmental Defense Fund, Heather Brichetti, who's the acting president and CEO of the Business Council of New York State. She's here with us today. Bob Cattell, who is the chairman of the Advanced Energy Research and Technology Center at SUNY Stonybrook and a board member of NYSERDA. Mark Bowling, who is the executive vice president and general counsel of Southwestern Energy. Senator Tom Libous, the deputy majority leader and represents the Southern Tier. And assembly member Donna Lupardo, who also represents Broome County, or a portion of Broome County. I want to thank each of the panel members for agreeing to participate. Obviously, they all bring a lot of wisdom and guidance and expertise to the table, and we're going to need it to complete this process. So what comes next? We're in the process of preparing this massive document for production, and we hope to post it on our website by the end of the week. We will have a limited number of copies available on CD today for reporters. And I'm sure Emily DeSantis will let you know how you can get those later on. Later this month, we expect to receive the socioeconomic research I mentioned and incorporate that into the SGIS. So that should be at the end of July. Once that's done, we'll revise the SGIS with the new information that we get from the consultants. We will put out a final draft, and that is at that point, we will start the 60-day public comment period. So that's important. People will have the summer to review the document that we've put out today, which is in the neighborhood of 900 pages including appendices. So they'll have a couple of months to do that, and then a formal process at the end of that. So we should have about 4 months for the public to look at this. After the public comment period, we'll go through a similar process that we went through last time. We will review all the comments. We have to provide responses to those comments, change the document as we feel appropriate based on those comments, and issue a final SGEIS. We expect and hope that that will be sometime around the end of the year. It is at that point, and only at that point, that DEC could begin to review permit applications. Then, following the issuance of the final SGEIS, we will start a rulemaking process. We are committing to incorporate all of the substance of the SGEIS in rules, and that will happen over the course of presumably 2012. So let me just say it one more time. No permits will be issued before the final SGEIS and finding statements are completed. And obviously, there's several steps in the process before we get there, and it'll be a fairly length, 6 months or so before we get to that point. Obviously, the last 6 months have been very busy ones for DEC. I've only been there for about four of them. DEC staff has worked tirelessly on this, along with Department of Health, the Public Service Commission, and lots of input from other agencies like DOT. And I want to publicly thank the DEC staff, particularly Brad Field, who is the head of our Minerals Division, who just, put their noses to the grindstone and got the job done. I've just gone over, obviously, a lot of information, and this, I believe, provides the framework for New York moving forward with this new process in New York, and we look forward to the next several months, because I'm sure even at the end of that process, the document will be improved once again. Because we do take public comments very seriously. I'm going to invite Gene Leth, who's a deputy commissioner with me at the agency and in charge of environmental remediation, including the oil and gas program, to join me. Jim Tierney, head of the water division at DEC, and Steve Russo, who is our general counsel and deputy commissioner. And we are available for comments and questions.
What's the earliest date we could see permits issued?
It's impossible to predict. It depends in part on how many comments we get. Last time around, we had 13,000 comments, as I said. They have to all be reviewed. They have to be categorized into substantive areas and then reviewed by the staff. They have to respond to them. We have to examine them, and again, how do we address them? If real issues are raised, we have to figure out if there's additional mitigation required. So all of that input gets used to generate the next phase of the document, going toward a final document. So it's just impossible to nail down a date. You know, last time it took months and months for that to happen. It depends on the volume of comments.
But it wouldn't be this year, right? It would be.
I'd say it is highly unlikely that it would be this year.
Is the DEC going to move to issue permits before that rulemaking process is codified into law?
Yes, we would.
And what's the thinking behind that?
Because the SGEIS will be the template for how we permit drilling for high volume hydraulic fracturing. All of the requirements in it will be incorporated into the permits that are issued to the applicants. We think they're completely enforceable, so there'll be no difference between what DEC does before and after a rulemaking. The rulemaking, in my mind, is belt and suspenders. It may be, in the past, I don't think DEC thought they needed to do rules, but a lot of the comments we received from people the last time around insisted that rules were better, more enforceable, they felt more secure with them, and we're going to go forward with rules.
I don't pretend to be an expert on this, but my understanding is that the oil and gas companies keep their chemical formula that you use secret. As far as I know, they were still doing that. Are you going to require them to reveal what these chemicals are so you could monitor and test them, and do you think they'll agree to that?
We will require them to give us all of the chemicals that are in the fracking fluids. Will require them to make them public, but they can basically apply to us for confidentiality of some based on trade secrets, and we'll have to review those applications at the time. And I'll have Steve Russo talk a little bit further about that.
The way it's going to work is it's important that the agency we'll have all the chemical information, and we believe industry will be agreeable to that, so that we can regulate it and understand what's in these. But then we're going a step further by also going to be requiring them to be publicly available, so that the public can see what's in these fracturing fluids. But in the process of making them publicly available, there are legal restrictions, and we have to give them the ability to say that something's confidential if it's legitimately confidential, and potentially not disclose the exact chemical names, but they would still have to give us some information to give the public an idea of what's in it.
Commissioner, you referred several times during these remarks to the 2009 study and pointed out differences between this and that. If there are all these differences now versus 2009, what does that say about the quality of the work of the 2009 study?
A lot has happened since 2009. This is a relatively new phenomena, even nationally. I mean, high-volume hydraulic fracturing is relatively new. Obviously, it hasn't happened in New York yet. So I don't think there's any question that parts of the 2009 SGIS weren't deeply enough done. They were shallow in places, particularly on the socioeconomic side. New York has had a long history with drilling, and we have a lot of expertise, but this is a relatively new method of accessing these deep shales. So we've lived and learned. We've got a lot of information from other states, obviously, and are going to benefit from their experience.
The people who live in those areas, though, might still be somewhat concerned if DEC itself is admitting that its own study from 2 years ago wasn't really great, then maybe they're not going to be so confident about this one either.
Our hope, obviously, is that people will see that we have erred on the side of caution. We've increased buffer areas. We have lots of increase in specifications. And I think, frankly, government and industry are both learning very quickly about how this should be done right. I mean, Pennsylvania has drilled thousands of wells. They've had a handful of bad experiences in Pennsylvania, and I think we've been able to isolate what the problems were and how we can correct them. So we're feeling very confident that we have the right controls built into this version of the plan, and we'll obviously benefit from 4 more months of comments on it and make any revisions necessary.
Commissioner, local communities will have to invite these wells in their backyard. That review on what they think about this will come down in August. How does the DEC allow hydrofracking without factoring in that review right now?
I'm sorry, the first part of your question I didn't hear.
Local communities will have to invite these wells into their backyards. They're going to have to deal with it. So how does the DEC say we'll allow hydrofracking before that review is even due?
We don't intend to allow hydrofracking before that review. The panel is going to help us look at those local impacts to communities and how we can prepare for that. So I'm not sure I understand your questions.
Misunderstanding, because basically, aren't we saying that we're going to allow hydrofracking with restrictions as it stands right now?
No, we're not. We haven't completed the process. So we are not entertaining applications for hydrofracking. We won't until we finalize this process that I just described. So we're not issuing any new permits. We're not issuing any permits for high-volume hydrofracking until this process is complete, including the study that is underway right now by E&E.
So when you say permitted on private lands, that's as we know right now, but there's still a lot of other reviews with communities and other aspects that can prove.
Well, permitted on private lands, that's down the road when we finish this process. This is still a draft document. It won't be finalized until we get the comment period over, which will probably be August or September and August. So we're not looking at a final SGEIS probably until late in the fall or early winter.
Okay, so that'll all be factored in then?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Could you say a little bit more about which parts of the 09 study you think were flawed?
I wouldn't say flawed is the right the way I would characterize it. I would say, again, we have lots more information now. I'd say in my opinion, places like where we're proposing to ban drilling is just an extra precaution. They didn't recommend that in the 2009 draft. They would have allowed drilling on state land. They would have allowed drilling closer to private water wells in primary aquifers. We just feel that there is a good reason for an excess of caution and to build in very, more stringent requirements than in the 2009 plan. So I wouldn't call it flawed. I would just think that we think that these controls are more appropriate, they're better, and they'll safeguard the environment.
Commissioner, environmental groups and the gas industry have said they're concerned that the letoffs at the DEC have made it difficult for the agency to grant permits once fracking is up and running. And also, provide adequate oversight. Do you guys have the staffing levels to do that?
We have limited staff right now. I've said in the past that we will only review those applications that we have the staff capacity to handle. Right now, we have limited staff capacity in the Minerals Division and in other divisions that would be required to participate, like the Division of Water. So part of the panel's responsibilities will be to look at the capacity of the state agencies, DEC and others, to properly implement this program. So they will make recommendations on how much additional staff. I think in the past, additional staff was recommended in the state budget. It was not ultimately approved, but it was probably premature because we still had a lot of work to do to try to figure out what the regulatory process would look like.
So could that create a backlog of permits? Could that create a problem down the road?
If we don't get additional resources, I would say yes, it could create a backlog in permits.
Will the permit fees be used to hire more staff to review, and how much is a permit fee going to run for a well?
Well, permit fees right now are based on so much per foot, I believe. So you're charged on the basis of the length of the well. So obviously with high-volume hydraulic fracturing, these wells are a lot longer. They will generate more permit revenue. I can't tell you or not whether that we think that's going to be adequate. We are going to look at that. We're going to ask the panel to look at that. We'll go back to the drawing board and see how much revenue we can anticipate under the existing scenario and whether that'll be adequate to fund not only DEC, but PSC, Department of Health.
Are the fees dedicated to that function rather than going somewhere else like the general fund or somewhere else?
I don't know the answer to that.
We can get back to
Commissioner, the opponents of hydrofracking can generally point to a lot of the horror stories, people with faucets that explode, you know, that catch fire. Can you speak to, do you feel that, that's overblown? And do you feel that these precautions you're putting into place will prevent such things like that?
The answer to your last question is yes, we do. Do I think they're overblown? I mean, people have, there's been serious incidents. How many of them were actually related to well drilling is a question. And, you know, it depends on, everyone had a different, you know, different set of circumstances. But they're real incidents and they're real concerns. And gas migration is the problem. And as I mentioned before, early on, when only surface casing was required, there was problems with gas migration, and that's why the intermediate casing as an extra layer of precaution. If the whole intention is to isolate the zones underground so that the shallow gas that they experience doesn't migrate into water supplies. So we think with intermediate casing, with new requirements on cementing, and poor cementing jobs were, you know, implicated in a lot of those cases where people ended up with gas in their wells. And we think that with proper cementing and this additional layer of casing, that problem will be essentially solved.
Commissioner,
even with all the precautions, I mean, things do happen once in a while.
Absolutely.
And if in a rare case somebody's drinking water was ruined, with, could they get recourse from the state? Would they have to go to the gas companies? Is there any provision for that in case some terrible accident happens and people are left with no water?
This is a good place to let the lawyer answer the question.
One of the requirements we're going to have that we're recommending is baseline testing of water wells within a certain range, about a couple of thousand feet of these wells. I think that's very important because you'll know before you start high-volume hydraulic fracturing what's in the well. Because sometimes the gas companies say, oh, the wells were, they were contaminated already. We didn't cause that. By requiring the baseline testing, we'll know what was in it before, and if somebody says there's a problem with their well after, we'll be able to get testing after and be able to compare them. So we think we'll be able to deal with that should something go wrong. And I think the setbacks and other things that we're requiring are also, as the commissioner just said, extra levels of caution because things don't always go right. And that really went into our thinking about what we were going to require here.
Commissioner, you've said in the past that you're not going to let this process move forward unless you deem it safe. Is this you definitively saying that you believe it can be done safely?
I believe it can be done safely. With all the precautions that we have built in to the process, I believe it can be done safely.
And have you presented this to Governor Cuomo yet, and he offered any sort of way of which way he's thinking on this as well?
I have not presented this to Governor Cuomo. He will get the report along with the rest of you today.
Commissioner, aside from the permit revenue, what is the benefit of this to the people of New York that overrides any potential environmental hazards?
I would reframe the question because I don't think it's going to override environmental protections. I think, you know, our feeling is that we can protect the environment and reap some of the economic and energy benefits from drilling in the Marcellus Shale. The consultants are looking at the economic benefits because, again, our data is old now. There's lots more experience in Pennsylvania and other places to assess. So we'll have more numbers for you, but those have been well reported in the press about how many jobs. I think Pennsylvania has had, I don't want to quote the number, tens of thousands of new jobs created. And you know, we saw in Pennsylvania when we were there, the unemployment rate in Bradford County is at about 5% when it's 10% in other places in the state and in surrounding states. They have experienced a boom of sorts. Now, that doesn't mean that there hasn't been problems that have gone along with it. There certainly has. And that's what we intend to address when and if we go forward with the regulatory program here.
Is the idea also that this would provide less expensive energy to the people of New York, that by drilling for this, you can get this natural gas and my natural gas bill will go down or maybe won't go up as high?
I can't promise how this is going to impact gas prices. It will obviously, having the gas produced in New York State has a lot of ancillary benefits, jobs, taxes, revenue to localities. There's currently ad valorem taxes in place, so localities would benefit, you know, tomorrow if there were drilling taking place. There would be more revenues coming into their coffers. Obviously, there's local costs involved, too, so I don't want to overstate one or the other, and they will be thoroughly analyzed in this next version when we get the consultant's report at the end of this month.
How much of the Marcellus Shale did you say would be open under this plan?
We said 85% in the press release. We're constantly trying to refine that number, and we're thinking upwards of 80% is the number we're using. We carefully GIS mapped all the resources that we have setbacks around or prohibited drilling in, and then looked at and also we took into account the fact that with horizontal drilling, you don't have to drill on top of something. You can drill next to it and get underneath. So you can access a lot of places that might be inaccessible if you were just stuck with a vertical well.
Today, in the press release, you said that high-volume fracking would be prohibited in Syracuse and New York City watersheds. Today, you said surface drilling. Which is it?
Well, it's a... in effect, it is a ban, both surface and subsurface, because it is a it's a ban on surface plus 4,000 feet. A horizontal bore doesn't travel more than 4,000 feet, so you will not be able to get into either one of those watersheds
as a
practical matter.
So a company could drill 4,001 feet and drill underneath the buffer zone, but not the actual watershed itself?
Yes.
Commissioner, if I'm a private landowner who is in an area where this would be allowed, what is your explanation to that person of why it's okay next to his property, but it's not okay in the New York City aquifer?
Well, we have lots of protection for water wells. If a person's water well, as I said before, there is no drilling within 500 feet of a person's private water well. We have lots of protections built in around water supplies, period.
Sounds like you're giving, even with these protections, you're giving a lower level of protection to some people than you are to the New York City or the Syracuse aquifers.
I think we've distinguished the New York City and Syracuse watersheds out because they are unfiltered drinking water supplies. They have what's called a filtration avoidance determination from EPA. If they had to filter, they would have to spend, in New York City's case, billions of dollars building a wastewater treatment plant, a water treatment plant. Likewise, in Syracuse, I'm sure the cost wouldn't be as great because it's not as big of a watershed. But these are very distinct, unique areas, and we're recognizing that as such by a total ban. It's not just the threat of accidents occurring, it is the threat that this FAD determination could be overruled because they are very sensitive, EPA is very sensitive to any type of activities that could occur on the surface of those watersheds. And again, the removal of that determination could result in billions of dollars worth of costs.
Commissioner, are there any circumstances or instances that would mean a permit would be pulled or rescinded otherwise?
I think if any time a permittee doesn't comply with a permit, that would be grounds to withhold approval and shut them down if necessary.
Say there's an incident where there's an explosion or something like that in Pennsylvania, would all permits be pulled at that point?
Well, I think that depends on the incident. I mean, it depends on scale. Who knows? If it's a serious enough accident and it looks like it has implications to all other wells, then sure, that'd be something we'd consider. But it's really, you'd need to know exactly what the circumstances are.
There were a few dozen permits that were pending before the SGEIS had even started that entire process. Are those technically still pending, and do they get first crack after this thing's finalized?
They're absolutely still pending. Whether they get first crack or not, I don't know. I'm not familiar with the specific applications that have been submitted.
So is that something that would be determined down the road?
I think that's safe to say. Sure.
Okay, one more question.
Who's liable if there are problems? Is it the company, or does the if someone's well is fouled from this process, where do they go to get this redressed?
I mean, it's a hypothetical question, and there's a lot of different factors, but as a general matter, if a gas company drilled a well and created harm to somebody else, they would be liable. It would be like any other concept in tort law.
Would the person who would have the claim go to DC? Would they go to a lawyer? Would they go to the company?
Right. I mean, it would be a private legal dispute. We don't create. I mean, they could go to DEC saying, enforce the law, you know, pull the permit, things like that, as to general enforcement. But if the person were seeking compensation, then it would be a private lawsuit.
Are there bonding requirements for drillers, or are there going to be bonding requirements?
This document doesn't propose any additional bonding requirements, and honestly, we can get back to you on whether the existing regulatory scheme does. I don't know the answer.
It's on our website. And that's all we've got time for, folks.
Thank you very much.